Greetings, Earthlings. I'm Robert J., and I am too lazy to type what I think. So I will flap my lips for a while here and speak what I think. And I think that we're still under sort of semi-lockdown, some more than others. I confess that I'm out there because I am a driver for Uber Eats. I hadn't driven at all. I hadn't done Uber Eats. I had done a few deliveries, and I decided it wasn't. I'd rather have people in the car with me than sandwiches because it's harder to talk to a sandwich. And so I just turned off that part of it, and so they took it out of my app. And now we're in a position where I don't, you know, I'm not going to drive with people. And but people are ordering food, and that's been determined an essential. Yeah, people got to eat, and it keeps them at home. It keeps people from going out that might not be well themselves or just, you know, making it crowded. So, anyway, I don't have to apologize. I'm driving Uber Eats. And so that's what I'm doing. So that means I can pay for the car. So that's what that's about. Anyway, today is a fantastic special show that I've been excited for because I got a chance to chat yesterday with a friend of mine named Levi Weaver, who is a currently writes for The Athletic as a beat writer for the Texas Rangers. And previously, in a previous life, he was a singer-songwriter, and that's how I got to know him. And so when he switched over and changed careers, I was disappointed, just, you know, for selfish reasons, because I like his music. But I guess there's nothing really for me to talk about here. It's a good recording. It's a good interview. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to play one of his songs, one of his later songs that I've always enjoyed. The song is called Song in My Branches. It's Levi Weaver. We'll be back after a break.
Grief for the living while they still have hands to caress, as you express the sort of poetic strands that for some reason we don't weave until nobody understands why they're gone so soon. We have so many plans and demand they listen now before the listeners go, cause we wait until they leave us, how we get it so wrong. And all the letters that we wrote we never passed along till the casket's last clasp is buckled down and locked. Make me a promise when I go you won't lock this body up in a casket. Let me grow from the ground so later you can fly around and sing your song in my branches. Make me a promise when I go you won't lock this body up in a casket. Let me grow from the ground so later you can fly around and sing your song in my branches. My fingertips into my eyelids hard. You are the shapes that dance around like living works of art. When the darkness of the night is all I have in my heart, you are the constellation saying keep your eyes on the stars. But if you leave before I leave, don't let it trouble you much, cause I believe a part of me will go there with you, love. And I know a part of you is there inside of my blood, so my heart will keep on dancing with you flood after flood. Make me a promise when I go you will lock this body up in a casket. Let me grow from the ground so later you can fly around and sing your song in my branches. Make me a promise when I go you won't lock this body up in a casket. Let me grow from the ground so later you can fly around and sing your song in my branches. Every breath in my lungs, so every time I try to speak, your thoughts are there on my tongue. A harmony so subtle, like we're singing as one, till the room begins to shake with us in resonant tones.
Our bodies came from stars, so let's return to form. Any light the way we did before the earth was born. In the darkness, spark another great electrical storm, until we leave all the survivors to remember and mourn. Promise when I go, you'll lock this body up in a casket. Let me grow from
when I go, you won't lock this body up in a casket. Let me grow from the ground so later you can fly around and sing your song in my branches.
Okay, we're back from the break now. This is Robert J, and I'm too lazy to type what I think, but I'm not too lazy to talk to people, and I'm very, very happy to be talking to a friend of mine named Levi Weaver, who is a... Now, are you a sports writer or are you a baseball writer?
Let's go with baseball beat writer. Yeah, beat writer, I think, is the right word there. I cover the Texas Rangers for The Athletic.
That's very cool. Was that... Now, were you always with The Athletic, or that's a relatively new group, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's fairly new. This will be my third season covering the Rangers for The Athletic. Before that, I was working for a TV station here in Dallas called WFAA. It's the ABC affiliate, and I was basically writing about baseball for their website. And then before that, I was a touring singer-songwriter, which is a complete different field altogether.
Well, and that's how we met. Yeah. As you were singing, and I was, we were doing the thing at the corridor, which is no longer...
That's right.
It's no longer... Well, the corridor sign is still up, but it's a, it's sort of a, it's a shelter for underage prostitutes to help get them out of the sex trafficking. That was...
Wow.
That's rampant up and down that boulevard. And so, yeah, I was part of the, I was part of the board that kind of started that going with some police officers that we knew. And so that's what it is now. That's a pretty cool thing.
Wow. That is very cool.
And I remember the last time I saw you was here in Seattle, and you were playing a quote house gig. It wasn't at a house, but it was at a... it was with the sisters.
Yeah. Seattle Living Room Shows.
Yeah. And that was the last time. And then you were almost, you said you were just about ready to move to Seattle. And then what happened?
Yeah. Yeah, so we were actually 3 days from, set my head on a shelf. We were 3 days from leaving to move to Seattle. And I was in Nashville. I was getting all of our stuff. So a little backstory for those that don't know. We lived, my wife and I lived in Nashville from 2007 when we got married until 2014. And then that was the year that we bought an RV. And I toured. I just was tired of traveling without my family. So I convinced Heather, my wife, to move into an RV with me. And we just drove around the country and played shows for a year. And it was great, but we couldn't do that forever. And so on a long drive, we kind of went through this list of places that we definitely didn't want to move to and places that we maybe could move to. And we narrowed it down and narrowed it down. And finally, we decided on Seattle. So, yeah, we were 3 days from leaving. I was in Nashville getting all of our stuff. I was snowed in Nashville after a show there. And Heather called and said she had been offered a job. She'd been doing some freelance work. And we're both from North Texas. Our families are from the Fort Worth area. And she'd been doing some freelance work while I was in Europe. And then it was, you know, it was a good job offer, and we didn't really have anything lined up in Seattle. We just kind of wanted to move there. And so we took it. We had to take it, and we stayed in Dallas. And that is where we are to this day. At the time, I think when we spoke, I was still planning on doing music. You know, I didn't realize that my career was sort of coming to an end. But then I couldn't figure out how to write a song anymore. I couldn't get anything written. Nothing was coming out. And this baseball thing kind of fell in my lap. And so so I took that. And now here I am writing about baseball for The Athletic.
And so you're a baseball guy, though, aren't you? You love that game.
Yeah. I've always been a fan. I mean, I say always. I discovered it when I was about eight. I was a very indoorsy child and liked to read a lot, and my dad was concerned that I was not doing enough physical activity, and so he tried to get me to play t-ball, and I probably predictably hated it. And then a couple years later, he bought a pack of baseball cards and started explaining the statistics to me, And when I started to understand the statistics, and then we'd watch the game on TV and he would explain the rules and like, here's what an RBI means and here's how you calculate batting average. And we would like calculate the player's batting average after every at bat. And once I understood the game, I kind of fell in love with it, and I started playing Little League and have been a fan ever since.
So your dad had the wisdom to appeal to your inner nerd, huh?
Yes, exactly. I love baseball because I am a nerd. That is exactly right.
So now, before that, tell me about your musical career. You know, just a Reader's Digest version, if you will, of how you got started, and you've just told me kind of why you finished. But
yeah, even the Reader's Digest version is quite convoluted. I didn't start playing guitar until I was 19. I played drums when I was in high school. And I got tired of being the guy that sat in the back, and I wanted to tell jokes to the audience. I wanted to interact with the audience. And there's only so many times you can lean down and try to like yell a joke into your snare drum mic. So I decided to start writing songs so that I could be the guy in the front. And I went on a missions trip, and they kind of let me work out the kinks of learning how to play guitar in front of, like school children in Guatemala when stakes were, I guess, relatively low. And that's how I got started. I came back to Texas, started a couple of different bands, and none of them were particularly good. Then I moved to England when I was 25. And started a solo like singer-songwriter thing. Picked up a loop pedal because I couldn't afford to have a band and didn't really have enough space for a band to practice anyway. And then in 2006, I entered a MySpace contest. That's how long ago that was now. And I got to open for Imogen Heap in Birmingham, which is where I was living over there, in the West Midlands. And I guess she liked it, and I did all right, and the audience liked it, and so she invited me to go on tour with her for her fall dates in the United States. And it was a 6-week long tour, and that was how it all kind of kicked off. I was opening for her, things went really well. I had to move back to the States because I couldn't get 6 weeks of vacation time for my job in England. And I had a placemat, like a laminated placemat with the map of the United States on it. And I knew I had to move back to the US, but I didn't really want to go back to Texas. And so I just spun it on the table. I remember spinning this placemat, closing my eyes and putting my finger down. And I looked up and my finger was on Chattanooga. And I went, well, there's no freaking way I'm moving to Chattanooga, Tennessee. But I've got some friends in Nashville and that's close. And so I just sort of fudged a little bit and slid my finger north by a couple hundred miles and moved to Nashville.
Well, it's certainly close enough.
Yeah, in the grand scheme of things.
Well, when we met, you were going to come on tour with this couple, and Tyler and somebody.
Yeah, Jenny and Tyler.
Jenny and Tyler, and she got sick and couldn't go, so you came with Jimmy Brown.
That's right. And that's crazy. I had forgotten that those were the circumstances for that tour. I did end up touring with them later in 2014, that year in the RV. We started with a tour with Jenny and Tyler, and they are still dear, dear friends of ours. But yeah, I had forgotten that was what happened there.
And I never met them. It's just kind of one of those things that, I was going to meet them, and then it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
Then we saw you twice in Seattle. One was some art studio near the stadium, and
excuse me.
We enjoyed the heck out of that. And the thing that I've always enjoyed about you and your music is that it's intelligent. It's not, and it's and as singer-songwriters go, you're also. You're also honest. You're kind of an honest songwriter in terms of, what's putting out what's in you. And
yeah.
Like you said, you didn't have any songs to write anymore. So rather than forcing a song that wasn't there, you just said, okay, well, this season's over for now.
Yeah. I don't know that I would cop to being intelligent. I think that that's probably. Thank you. That's a very nice thing to hear. But I will say, yeah, I think that I was very honest in my songwriting, and I hope that was. But I don't think I'm unique in that. I think a lot of my favorite songwriters are very, very honest about what they're going through, and I think that's part of what draws me. I think to not just music. I think that can be done in, poetry or playwrights or even TV. I think there are TV shows where the writers are very honest. So, to be counted among those honest writers, I think that's a huge compliment. And I hope that I did that well.
Well, yeah, and maybe it's hard to say if it's an intelligent song or not, but I think you're an intelligent guy. And so you're intelligent enough to know I got to do this honest or not do it at all. And there's,
yeah.
Like, I just spoke, my last episode that we recorded was with Daphne Lee Martin, and who's okay. a singer-songwriter up in New London, Connecticut. And they were working on her, I think, fifth album when the shutdown happened. She was getting ready to go into the studio, so that's been put on hold for a while. So how's the shutdown, how's that happening in Dallas right now?
Yeah, we are on shelter at home orders until the end of April, which basically means stay at home. Don't do anything unless you have to. And there are, like essential workers. So grocery stores are still open and restaurants are still open, but for takeout only. It's wild. I've done some delivery orders, but mostly have not done takeout. But I did last night. There's a Japanese restaurant that I went to, and it's basically just you walk up to the door and the door is shut. Nobody can walk in, and there's just like a lady at a table. You tell her your name, and she goes back into the restaurant and gets the food and brings it out. So everything is weird right now, man. Nothing is normal. And I think for me, a lot of the, a lot of what has made it weird, like if somebody told me, I told my wife this morning or maybe last night, I don't know, time is wobbly right now, but I remember
it's Friday
saying recently,
it's Friday and nobody cares.
Yeah. Is it? Who knows? I'm amazed that I remember that we were doing our podcast right now. I'm proud of myself for that. But I remember saying that if somebody told me, all right, this is going to go until the end of May, you have almost two more months that you have to be in your house working from home, not going anywhere. But at the end of May, it's all going to go back to normal and everything will be okay. I think that for me would not, I would kind of shrug and be like, all right, well, this is going to be challenging, but we're going to get through it. End of May, there's our deadline. But I don't think that's it. I don't think, first of all, that end of May is necessarily a reasonable deadline, but also I don't know that there's going to be a normal again, the way that we knew it. I think there will be a new normal, and I think some of that is good. Hopefully it's good in that we recognize the need for like health insurance to not be tied to your job, because jobs are so fragile. I mean, how many millions of people were kicked off of their healthcare in the middle of a global pandemic in the last month because they lost their job? Like, hopefully that changes and shifts. Hopefully we recognize that the need to pay teachers more, and we recognize their value a little bit more. Hopefully this is something that where we recognize even like food service industry workers and the minimum wage should be more because of the services that they provide. I hope that those things change for the better. But there's also part of me that fears, like I lived through 9/11. I saw how it became a power grab. I saw how the Patriot Act is still 20 years later in existence, and we can declare war on people now just because the president declares them to be a terrorist organization, even if they don't fit the traditional definition of terrorist organization. I lived through the 2008 collapse where nobody who was responsible for it went to jail, and millions of people lost their homes, and people who had a bunch of expendable money, went and bought all those homes, and then made a lot of money off of that collapse. And I mean, Steven Mnuchin is the Secretary Treasurer right now. He made millions of dollars by capitalizing on a national tragedy. And so part of me wonders where that's going to go. How, when the other shoe falls, when we emerge from this with a new normal, what are we going to do to prevent that from being the new normal? And I don't have good answers for that. And I don't know how long it will be before that makes itself clear, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's like you said, if we knew, okay, here's the end date and we all go back to work, baseball starts, soccer plays, it's all, you know, everything is sunshine and lollipops. Yeah, it'd be cool. But, my thing is just because some politician says the virus is over and you can all come out of your, you know, hiding places now, doesn't mean that virus is going to go away. I don't think it's not going to go away. It's here and it's going to be there until we find a way to combat it. So I'm thinking of things like, you know, the new normal is going to be the new economy, where people are going to design fancy, stylish designer hazmat suits that we can all wear. And, you know, so we can all go about our business. And, you know, I can drive Uber. I can teach my students looking like an astronaut. And, but my, what I do with my, you know, our school is for special needs students that are 18 to 21. And it's about helping them learn to get job skills. And so we go to, you know, I take three people a day. My place was the golf course, and they wash the golf carts, and they, you know, so it's not a, you know, okay, we can come into the school, into this little protected place. So, yeah, it's all, we're all waiting to see how this is going to shake out.
Yeah, what does a job search even look like in 6 months? You know, what jobs are even still around, and which, what new jobs exist, and how do you train for those new jobs? And I mean, it's all, there's no part of this that is not in upheaval right now.
And especially, yeah, when the people that have money are going to do everything they can to keep that money, and the people that don't have money are either honest people and they're going to suffer, or they're dishonest people and they're going to steal it.
Right. Yeah. And it's, I do think it's incumbent upon, you know, not to just beat a dead horse here, but you've got people who have billions of dollars that are going to be fine. They are going to be fine.
Yeah.
And it is incumbent upon them in a moment of national tragedy and panic, and we're on the verge of a possible depression here.
Right.
I think it is their moral duty and responsibility to do whatever they can to, you know, we just saw Jack, the guy, the CEO of Twitter, said he donated I need to go back and read the details, but basically like contributing $1 billion of his stocks towards fighting this. And like, you know, he could have done a better job of getting the Nazis off of Twitter, but that's respectable. Like, that is
right.
I think what we need to see other people of those means.
Bill Gates
do.
There's some good guys out there with a lot of money. Not, you know, I don't want anybody to think that I think anybody that's a billionaire is a bad person, but some of them realize that they got to where they got to, you know, on the backs of others, and so, you know, they don't have a problem paying back. There's the people that feel they're entitled to it, and I won't mention any names, but I don't hold my breath on waiting for them to do the right thing.
Hey, sorry about that. I stepped away for a second. Sorry, this is very unprofessional. We had the lawn crew hasn't been here in 3 weeks, and they showed up just as we started. And I had to let them know about the tomato plants that we have planted in the meantime. So I apologize for that distraction.
Professional implies money being made.
All right. Sorry, I'm back now.
So I'm not worried
about
it.
All is well.
So how are your kids doing with this?
Good. Good as they can. We're doing some school work from home, as far as like, you know, just packets that we can print out at home. They have their sort of Zoom video classes once in a while. So they'll get a chance to hop on video with their classmates and teachers, and we're doing okay. I feel really, really fortunate. I cannot imagine how this would have been different if it happened while we were, you know, that year when we were living on the road in an RV and we were making our living from people coming together in small spaces and living rooms. And I mean, that we would have gone bankrupt within a month. And, you know, now the Athletic is a pretty stable company. They've done a lot to prepare for things like this. We have not been furloughed. Heather's working for the American Heart Association. She still has a job. I mean, we are so, so lucky to be able to stay at home and not have to go work at a grocery store and expose ourselves to, you know, however many hundreds of people a day come through grocery stores. We're doing well, and I feel a little almost guilty at how lucky we are to be in the position that we're in. But, you know, rather than let that become guilt, you know, we just use that as an opportunity to help where we can. It's not morally wrong that we are as lucky as we are, but it is also then, just as I said, it becomes incumbent upon the billionaires to help out. To a lesser extent, like, I am in that same boat. It's incumbent upon me to help people where I can. And so whether that's my friends that are in the service industry or musicians or, you know, whatever, if I can help out by helping somebody's Patreon or, you know, just sending a tip on Venmo once in a while to somebody that works in the service industry, then, you know, that's almost a moral obligation for me to do that.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, everybody, if everybody does what they're able to do, you know, what I'm able to do might not be as much as what someone else is able to do. But if everybody did all the way up to the top, you know, we'd be in pretty good shape.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I feel like I could get on a real soapbox here, but some of it would be opinion and emotion rather than logic and facts. And I don't know that I want to necessarily go on the record with my opinions and emotion of all this.
We'll save that for another time.
Yeah.
Conspiracy theory edition.
Yeah. You know what's wild is I think there is just so much real life stuff right now. I just have not had time for any conspiracy theories, and because it's bad enough, right? Like, conspiracy theories are usually like everything's fine, and then somebody brings up, well, what if it's not fine, and what if there's this,
and then we play the
secret cabal of,
we play the X-Files,
right, music. There's this secret yeah, and now it's like, why? It's bad enough, man. We don't need to talk about Pizzagate or QAnon right now. Like, there's no time for these silly conspiracies when there's real life happening.
Have you seen the series Deep State?
No, I haven't.
Oh man, it's a kind of a CIA kind of thing, but there's a privately run organization that kind of runs the government from the shadows. And going over and starting wars in the Middle East so that they can go, you know, make money off of rebuilding the countries. And that's not too far away from reality, but let's not go there because they might be listening.
Yeah, right. I don't care. I'll say it. Like, that's not even conspiracy theory. There's enough history that is provable to know that the United States has done that, you know, specifically in Latin America and the Middle East on a number of occasions.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's not always a pretty thing out there.
No.
Well, the one good thing is, though, it's kind of, in one sense, moved us all a little bit closer together as we stand further apart. You know, we're all kind of, we've got the same enemy right now that we're fighting. And that's not always the case. You know, we haven't had a thing like that here since World War II, really. 9/11 briefly, you know, but that was, you know, that was just a blip. But
and I think with 9/11, some of us kind of banded together and picked the wrong enemy as well.
Well, that's That's true. But there's no mistaking. But right now, we got to get, you know, get ourselves clear of this infection. And, you know, whether it's, but, you know, and like I said, I don't think it's going to go away. I'm just hoping and praying that the next, what's the polio guy, Dr. Salk, I hope.
Yeah, Jonas Salk. Yeah.
Another Jonas Salk out there that's wanting to make a cure for this, you know, for not making a profit.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the second half of that is important, too, that it's, it is something that is not just for the rich who can afford it, but that it becomes a universal thing for the good of us all. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, you're right on there.
So what do you think? How do you think the independent music industry is going to come out of this?
I mean, it doesn't look good logically, but I do know this about artists. They are a creative bunch, and they are, I'm old enough now to have seen the advent of the internet, and that kind of, everybody thought, oh my gosh, now we can all be heard by everyone, when there are no longer any gatekeepers, and we are going to be on level ground with the major label artists. And that, of course, didn't happen. And so we saw people figure out a way to make it through that. And then, you know, here comes Napster and all of these things that are supposedly killing the music industry. And you saw some people sink, but you saw a lot of other people swim and learn how to navigate that. And then you've seen people learn how to navigate with the advent of Spotify, which I think from a listening standpoint is one of the greatest inventions. I do hate to see how it has, in some cases, in a lot of cases, negatively affected artists, but you see people learn how to navigate that, and they have gotten on the road, and it becomes touring, and all of a sudden vinyl makes a comeback because it's being pitched as nostalgia. Now this is happening, and I think there will be a lot of indie artists that are very negatively affected by it, but I think there will also always be artists who are creative and find a way to thrive and find a way to continue to make music and all of this. And I look forward to seeing how that happens and supporting it where I can.
Well, I think the cool thing about the age that we're in, you know, the technology age, is that everybody has access. Well, a theoretical everybody, in that, you know, you don't have to have a recording contract now to make your music. And you can be, you know, for lack of a better term, you can be an internet busker, you know, YouTube busking, you know, and you know, why not? And someone stumbles upon that, you don't have to have some suit up in, you know, whoever, Columbia's offices decide whether or not you're going to sell a million records.
Right, you just need to get an influencer to post about you.
Exactly.
It's not the CEO of Columbia Records anymore. Now it's a Kardashian. If you can get a Kardashian to post about you, you got it. You made it. Or Justin Bieber, or, you know, Collins Key, or whoever it might be. I know YouTube people now because I have kids and they watch YouTube things. So it's, you know, some that I know who to. Actually, I say that. I know Collins Key. That's it.
Well, you're a dad. You're not supposed to know everything.
Yeah. Yeah, my job now is not to be on top of these trends. My job now is to make sure that we have food.
Right. Which being a musician isn't always the way to do that, is it?
No, it's not. And I don't know that was a conscious part of the decision, but maybe subconsciously that was part of it. Of like, you can't keep doing this forever, and you've got to be responsible. So, yeah, that's maybe subconsciously part of the reason why my brain stopped coming up with songs. Maybe it was like, this is for your own good. We're not doing this anymore.
Well, maybe you can become a YouTube busker.
Oh, no, I'm much too old for that now.
Oh, I don't know.
No, I do not have my pretty 20-year-old face anymore. I turned 40 this week, which is not to say that there's no value in anything that I do. That's obvious. I'm not saying that by any means. But to become a famous YouTuber, it is too late. I would have had to have started 20 years ago.
Well, you can be a novelty because you're so old.
Yeah, I'm not old enough to be a novelty, though. Like, I need to be about 70. Yeah. If I was 70, I could make this work. I would get on and I would do rap songs as a 70-year-old. I would kill it. It would be amazing. I'm in that middle age where I just have to be responsible now.
So you still have all your gear, right?
Some of it. Most of it. I actually did dismantle my pedal board after the last show in January, which is something I hadn't done in the 5 years when it was sitting in storage. It was still all put together and on the pedal board, but I went ahead and took it apart. I don't have my Pro Tools. My recording stuff is gone. We sold that, I think, when we left Nashville. But I've got a couple of mics, and I still have my guitars. And yeah, so for the most part, I still have it, yeah.
Okay. Well, I used to, when I was doing the radio show, I always dug having your music on because there was a certain, realness to it. You weren't just trying to satisfy a suit or a 13-year-old girl.
Yeah, it was funny when people would ask me, you meet people in airports or restaurants or whatever, and, what kind of music do you play? And my response was always a very rapid and without hesitation, sad. What kind of music do you make? Sad. And Heather, my wife, was like, you have to stop telling people that. Nobody, you're going to make them not want to listen to your music. And I said, no, I'm finding my audience. Because if somebody is expecting to hear a pop song, or a country song, or whatever, and they listen to what I do, they're going to be very disappointed. But if I say sad, there are some people that are going to hear that and be like, "Oh, well, turns out I love sad music. I will listen to it." And I think that was a sort of self-selecting bit of information that I was giving out. But yeah, I mean, it was
Well, I found a lot of your songs to be thought-provoking.
That's a big compliment. I like that. That's a good one.
Because whether it was sad or not so sad or whatever, it had words that you would say, "Oh wow, I hadn't thought of things like that before."
Yeah, I think part of that was probably just growing up a preacher's kid and thinking that I was going to go into the ministry and kind of viewing the world through that lens of always. There is a certain, is it possible to use the word patronizing without it necessarily being a pejorative? Like, it is a patronizing thing to look at the world and to read and to take in everything under the auspices of, I'm going to use this to help somebody make their life better. I mean, that is really presumptuous, I think. But it is a certain way of taking in information, and I do think it probably informed and I moved away from the thought of being in the ministry and just became strictly a musician. Like, I was no longer trying to proselytize necessarily. And I was, wrestling very hard with my own understanding of faith and what that even meant. But I had still processed all this information in a way that was like, how can I use this information to try to make better sense of the world and then pass that along? And so I won't claim that I interpreted it all correctly or even passed it along all correctly. I mean, there are things that I wrote that I don't think were exactly accurate. But hopefully at some point you trust your audience to take in that information and make up their own mind, I guess.
Well, you like to hope that you live your life in a way that makes things better for people. And
absolutely.
And whether it just gave somebody a smile that needed one or just made somebody sit and have a hard think about their own life and where they're going. And so, well, this is cool. I'm glad that we got to chat. Is there anything else that you would like to, any thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners in terms of getting through what we're getting through?
Oh, gosh. No, but I do think you said something that I wanted to reiterate because I think it was a very good point. You said it to live your life in a way that makes others' lives better. I think that's the biggest difference between between the way that I used to take in information and the way that I hopefully try to take it in now is like it becomes. I mean, there's a scripture that talks about faith without works is dead, right?
Right.
Oh my gosh, the lawn crew is right outside my window. Can you hear them?
It's all right. This is live.
About
baby.
Faith without works. Yes. About faith without works being dead. And I understand that verse differently now as an adult, in that it was one thing to philosophize about how to make the world a better place or to save the lost or to, you know, preach the gospel or whatever. And I now see it completely differently, in that, like, the reason that you take in this information is so that you can become a better person and that you can make the world a better place by what you do, not by just what you preach. And it's okay to put words to what you're doing. It is okay to explain what you're doing with words, but the actions, I think, should come first. You should do things that you believe are the right thing to do and take those actions. And then if those actions cause somebody to take notice and they ask, you know, why are you doing this, or what prompted you to do this, what was your inspiration, then by all means, you know, use that as an opportunity to explain your belief system, I guess. If you are preaching first, then nobody cares. And I think we are seeing that probably more, a more stark example of that now than ever before. And that, like, that's great. You can get on Twitter or Facebook and pound the table all you want, but what are you doing? You know, what are you doing to make this better? What are you doing to help? And if the answer is nothing, then I don't really care at all what your philosophy is. Your philosophy is useless. If it's not changing you, if it's not making you help to make the world a better place, then why on earth would I care? Why would I want to adopt that philosophy? And so I think that was a very poignant thing that you said, and I wanted to make sure that I processed that also.
I think we file that under show, don't tell.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even, like, it could be even show, then tell. You know, that's fine.
Right.
But show, for sure.
Well, so you make them want to ask, and then you can tell.
Yeah. Yeah, and that also goes back to something that I feel like I learned years ago, which was about, you know, relationship building. I don't think, you know, I remember growing up and seeing people, I still see, well, not now, but, you know, as recently as a few months ago, people on the streets with their signs, or they're handing out tracts, and they're, you know, the end is near and repent. And like, that's, what are you doing, man? Like, what relationship have you built? Why, what about your life is causing these people to see that your life is a better way to live life? Are you actively, you know, and I know that faith should transcend politics, and it does, but are you voting for people who are actively harming the most vulnerable among us? What sermon is your vote preaching? You know, what are you doing to help or harm others in your actions? And then, so yeah, the relationship building is, I think, step one. Maybe step one is live your life in a way that is attractive or that makes the world a better place. And you know what? Even if you never get another chance to share your faith as a result of that, or even talk about faith as a result of that, and even if then you've still made the world a better place. You've still done good. You've still done. You've made the world better, not worse. And then step two, I think, is the relationship building. Who was it that there's a famous quote? This is, I'm going to Google this while I got my laptop in front of me. St. Francis of Assisi. It says, preach the gospel at all times. When necessary, use words. I think that really, I just spent 10 minutes trying to say what Francis of Assisi said in like 10 words. But that's why he's famous and I'm not.
And he gets to have statues with animals all around him.
Yeah. You know what, though? Actually, hold on. As I'm Googling here, it's always attributed to St. Francis of Assisi, but it might not be him. We're doing fact-checking in real time. According to this website, he never said it.
Oh, okay. So, well, whoever said it.
Whoever said it. That's a good
Mother
quote.
Teresa, whatever.
Yeah, it was spoken by the venerable Bart Simpson.
Well, Levi, I know that you got to take off in just a minute, so I'm going to thank you for coming on and hope that we can come on again. Maybe once the season gets started, we can come on and have a baseball chat.
Yeah, that'd be great. Who even knows what that's going to look like this year? There have been all sorts of wild theories thrown
everybody
out.
Everybody plays in Arizona.
Yeah, maybe.
That's
maybe. There's so much. The logistics of that are just staggering. But yeah, it's a possibility.
All right. Well, so until next time, I'm switching off here.